Session number 10037, reel number 2.
Jepson, reel 2. Were you surprised at the Japanese air power?
Well, I was really, because they seem to have. They used to send over normally at least 3 raids a day, and they'd come over in a whole squadron of 27 and drop all their bombs, usually in the target area, and then off back again. And they seem to have plenty of air power there.
How about their planes? Did they surprise you?
Well, I hadn't seen them really close to, and most of the bombers flew at a fairly high altitude. It wasn't until later, when I joined the Flying Tigers, that I began to see more of their planes and their, you know, capabilities. That's when I began to realise then that they were quite a powerful nation. But referring back to when I was out on the satellite airfield, after that, after the more or less the satellite airfield had been discovered and bombed, they apparently abandoned it, and that's when I came back to Insin and into the convent school billets, you see, afterwards. And then after I'd been back there a few days, we still had no planes. I think 17 Squadron received 3 Hurricanes then. And I was called into the adjutant's office one day and said that would I go over to the Americans, which were the Flying Tigers, as they had radio problems, and see if I could do anything. So I went over, and they'd got 9 fighters there, I think it was 9 flying, but only 2 of them had their radios working. And so I stopped and worked, and I went back each day and did it. And I think we got about 7 out of the 9 working. Of course, they were old, naturally old-fashioned radios, not like the VHF they have now. They were working on 100 metres approximately, and all the wave changing was done by Bowden cable. You see, you pulled a thing out to change the frequencies. And anyhow, they, of course, their American technique is entirely different to ours. Their philosophy had all been, if a thing went wrong, well, you took it out and threw it away and stuck another one in. But of course, with supplies being non-existent, they had to find somebody who could take the units to pieces and try and find out. But they had nobody. They had 1 or 2 good operators, very good operators, but they weren't mechanics, you see. So that's how I came to be sent over to work on them.
Yes. Well, what was their activity against the Japanese at that time? You know, were they much in evidence?
Oh, yes, quite a lot. They were about the only real fighter defence we had. And they would take off. But it was very difficult even for them, because we had no air raid warnings, because the Japs were, sometimes they got it from somewhere, an advanced place down to the Malay Peninsula, well over towards Maumee and places like that, and they would get a radio mission, then they would take off. But of course, me being with them then, you used to kind of fit in with all kind of things. You used to try, when they came in, you'd help to refuel them or rearm them or help the armourer and things like that. So I got quite involved with them. I mean, you couldn't stand around, because you couldn't get on with the radios, because they were then in the air. So when they came back, you naturally mucked in and did what you could in other directions. And this is how I got, you know, quite acquainted with them.
Well, what did you know about them at that time? You know, were they called the Flying Tigers?
Yes,
then?
They were called the Flying... well, they were called the AVG, the American Volunteer Group. And they were nicknamed the Flying Tigers because I think they were the first people to ever paint their planes with a tiger mouth. Many, many squadrons copied it afterwards, you know, and have done since. But I think they were the original people who did it. And they, of course, named the Flying Tigers. And they were all mostly American servicemen who I understand now had been recruited from the American services earlier on. I don't really know what their motives are. Some, I think, were rather mercenary. They thought it was another thing. I think they got fed up with the routine of normal service life, and it was an opportunity for a bit of adventure. And others were just mad on flying. You know, they were a mixed bunch.
Would they have been there before America officially was in the war?
Oh, yes, they were there since, I think, about 1938, 37. Oh, yes, they'd been up and they'd flown in China when parts of those had been bombed, parts of China were being bombed. That's where their original job was. But when Burma began to be threatened, I think the British made a request that they would go down into Burma and try and prevent or give top cover to the troops and a top cover for Rangoon and places like that, which they did. They sent the squadron down to Mingledon.
And what were these planes that they had?
Well, they were P-40s. They called them P-40s, but the British, I think, called them Tomahawks. They were, well, I don't know their really technical or flying capabilities, but they seemed to be quite a good plane. They were quite fast and reasonably manoeuvrable. And they carried, I think most of them, two cannons. You know, and that's another job I used to help, because working in the cockpits, and they were so short of people, I mean, whereas the RAF would employ 100 people, they had about four to do the same amount of work in their squadron. And I used to sit in the cockpit on occasions and just press the trigger, because they used to set them up and then put a target about 100 yards away, and the armour used to be adjusting the cannons, you know, and then I would just occasionally press the trigger, and then he'd look and see where it landed and make the necessary adjustments. That saved him climbing down, climbing up. And matter of fact, we did all kinds of things, you know, to help out with them. But anyhow, to go farther, I used to go over to the Americans, which were an entirely separate part of the airfield, probably a mile or so away from the British. And I used to go over about first thing in the morning, and I'd work all day. I'd have my meals over with them. Of course, that was an advantage, because their meals were far better than ours. And so that was an incentive. And I used to work all day over there, and I'd work sometimes until it got nearly dark, because there was nothing much else to do. I wasn't very interested in naffies or things. And so I used to work and go home.
What name of the airfield was it?
Mingledon.
It was still at Mingledon.
Mingledon,
yes.
Yeah, Mingledon Airfield. Yeah. And so, but one day I went back, and I got back, it was getting nearly dark, and went up into the dormitory to find it was in a state of chaos. And everybody's kit bag and things had gone except mine. Mum were by my bed still there. And, of course, I didn't realise, I didn't know what had happened. And I went and looked around. By then it was getting dark, and I couldn't see anybody. So I went back to the billet and spent a pretty uncomfortable... I didn't sleep a lot because I didn't know what had happened.
Well, wasn't a message left?
Nothing. Nothing at all. It was just... I just went up into the room, and then it was empty. Everybody had gone. And so in the morning I got up naturally. I was up before daybreak and making my way up. And there were no... Normally there were lorries and that running around. There were no lorries. And I went up towards the airfield. And then I did meet a jeep. And in it were two RAF chaps. And I said, well, what's happened? Oh, he said, they've all gone. I said, well, he said, they've gone out. I thought, what I think is the last boat out. And so I said, well, what's happened? He said, there's a few of us have been detained to destroy all the dumps and radio, and in other words, to destroy as much equipment as possible. And he said the adjutant's instructions were that if possible, they would fly in a transport plane and then fly us out. He said, if not, we were told to make our way as best we could to India, which, of course, was about 2,000 miles, most of it being through jungle. And anyhow, I saw these chaps from time to time. But anyhow, I went back to the Americans, and the chap in charge, the squadron commander, was a Captain Olson. I told him what had happened, and he said, well, he said, squadron commander had detailed you to me. He said, so you better stop with us. I'll be responsible for you. So I continued working for them.
Wait, were you happy to do that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I couldn't. There was nothing much else I could do, really. And I was at least got a job. And I wanted to go to somewhere where I could get some food and stuff. So I could do nothing else, really. And, well, I didn't want to. I was quite happy at the job.
How had they treated you? How you would have been, am I right in thinking, the only...
I was the only RAF chap at that moment, yeah, with them. And, well, very well. At the time, of course, you got a lot of ribbing. I was, you know, they used to call you a gold down limey and things like that. But, I mean, they were a tough lot. And eventually, I got in quite well. And afterwards, I found that, well, there was nothing that they wouldn't do for you in the end. They were very... very generous in all respects, because I lost a lot of my clothes later on, and I mean there was always someone would always find a shirt for you or something like that there, even a pair of boots, because I only had RAF shoes we were issued with, and the shoes got pretty grim and they weren't very practical. And another one gave me a pair of what they call sand boots, I think, which are like very half short riding boots, and I got on with them very well indeed towards the end.
So you really sort of became part of their unit?
Yes, I did in the end, yes. Well, then we went on operating there, and after we'd been operating for about 4 or 5 days, of course, operating became very difficult, because they every day the airfield would get bombed at night, because we had a lot of people who didn't like the British in Burma. And I think they used to light fires out in the jungle, like at about half a mile radius from the airfield. And then all the Japs did at night was come over and drop all their bombs in the centre of this circle. And, of course, the airfield was practically ready. Well, when you came up in the mornings, one of our first jobs was to walk the whole length of the runway and any surrounding places. And you'd come across a small hole and you'd look down and you'd see the tail of a bomb. And then you'd stick a stick in with a red flag on it, because it was a delayed action bomb. And they would be going off every half an hour sometimes during the day. But so that people would avoid them and the aircraft could avoid them, they used to stick sticks, and we used to just walk, have an area which we used to do, and walk across sometimes. But there were so many also craters, and all the local labour had gone. So eventually it became very difficult for the planes even to take off. And this was part of the problem, because the runway became practically inoperable, you see. And so I got called into the office and said, would I go down with another American down to the docks? Well, it wasn't until I got in the lorry, and he said, I thought we were going down to get some more anything. He says, oh no, he says, you see any food you can see, he says, you collect it and put it in the back of the lorry. So off we went down to the docks, and there were some Indian guards, but they just waved as we drove through into the docks. And then we started a tour of all the warehouses, and anything that looked like food we put into the back of the lorry, which we did, and then went off back to the airfield.
Was there much in the warehouses? Oh,
the warefield, there was an enormous amount. I saw boxes of brand new crates of brand new British Lee Enfield rifles laying around. And the rotten part was that I'd been issued in England, and I was still carrying it, an old Canadian Ross rifle, which weighed about a ton and was a straight bolt action. And it was all the, but I couldn't exchange it, because it had been issued to me and it had got a number on it, and I knew, because to lose your rifle was a very serious offence. Anyhow, I'm practically certain of it now, that a lot of those Lee Enfield rifles found their way up into China and were eventually sold. And I understood that the Chinese paid about £100 each for them in rupees, and I think that quite an amount of money was made possibly by some of the Americans. In fact, I know it was.
And that would have been sold to individual Chinese rather than the army.
Well, as far as I know, I didn't have anything to do with it, but I know a vast amount of money was made. But they were all left on the docks, and they would have gone into the Japanese would have had them, and all kinds of stuff, and there was lots of stuff laying around, but, you know, and all stuff, the crates of things, and what they contained, I don't know.
Did you get any idea yourself of the actual defence of Rangoon, the numbers of troops there?
No, I don't. There didn't seem to be... Most of the soldiers I saw were Gloucesters, and I think there were some King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. I met them from time to time, you know, and spoke to them, but I don't think many of those ever came out. I'm sure they didn't. And it was a pretty rough time altogether. And anyhow, we took all these boxes back. One we uncovered, I always remembered, was a crate of sauerkraut, tins of sauerkraut. I know I tried it, but it was, I don't think it was cooked. I just tried it, but it didn't suit my palate. And another one was we had a crate of scotch. It looked like blackberry jelly, but I think it must have been some other kind of jelly. We were quite... that came in quite useful because that spread on hard tack because we didn't get any bread. Of course, there were no bakers or anything, and no supplies at all, really. It did make it... You could get the biscuits down a bit better. Of course, when we were down in Rangoon, we could observe that the place was in an utter state of chaos. All the prisons had been opened, and all the even the leper colonies... And a matter of fact, there were no police, but the soldiers were around to prevent looting. And I remember we stopped, and there was a big store. I think it was called Rowan Sons, almost like a mini Salvages. And you could just walk around there, and there were all things about in it. And there were an enormous safe on the wall, which I suppose, I don't know what it contained, but there were lots of bullet marks all around the safe, but nobody had succeeded in opening it. I think if you had tried. And another thing, there were two brand new Buick special cars in there. Well, they were purloined, I know, by the Militant Volunteer Group members. One of them finished up a brand new car in, I think it had done about 70 miles, hitting a bridge and being wrecked. But the other one was driven right up the Burma Road and eventually finished up in China, which I think was used by some of the high-ranking officers, you know, for driving about in. Because transport was a terrible problem, you know, then up in China. It wasn't so much in Burma, because as people were evacuating, they were even throwing the keys to the troops to, you know, they could take their cars and do anything, because they were no good to them. And there were some beautiful houses in Rangoon. It was a beautiful place. And you could walk into these houses, and the houses would even there'd be a meal on the table where they'd all evacuated, you know, and gone at the last minute. And it was really in a state of chaos. And then later on, after it got bombed, the last sight I saw of it, it was large portions of it were in flames. Mm.
This, of course, you know, first of all India, and then Rangoon, this would have been your first contact with the East, wouldn't it?
Oh, it was, yeah.
I was wondering, you know, was there much culture shock?
Culture shock was terrible. My first sight of India, and I'll never forget it, because coming from England, and in those days, we were a little more courteous than they are today, so it probably might not be such a culture shock to the present day people. It was, my view was, of rows of Indian women running up and down planks with baskets of coal on the head and shooting it into the hold and then running down another plank, being given another one and running up and down. Of course, to me, this was absolutely terrible. And then on our journey across India, at every station we stopped, or wherever we stopped, beggars would appear, some with the most distorted of limbs, blind, covered in sores. It was shocking, and it was. I mean, eventually, for the first month, one tended to feel constantly sick and, you know, really turned over. But it's amazing, after a time, you come to terms with things, otherwise you couldn't exist. You do come to terms with it. I saw many things that turn you over there. Even in China I did afterwards, but as I say, it was a shocking culture shock to start with. Mm. And another thing which, of course, I realise it was silly now, but everybody spits out there. It's terrible. The spitting is shocking. And in Rangoon, I remember seeing all red marks and, you know, people spitting about. And I thought, well, everybody must suffer with consumption out here. And, of course, it wasn't until a little while after I discovered that they all chewed betel nut, which, of course, is all red, and the spitting. And it is. Even in China, the spitting. I know it's a disgusting thing to talk about, but it was horrendous, really. And the spitting out there was so terrible that the fellows got quite complacent in the end, and the spitting seems to start from right down low in the stomach, and you can't imagine what it's like. And the troops often, one would say to another, when one of these terrible honks took place, there's another toenail gone. And I remember also that I was walking down the street, this was later on when I was in China, and two beautifully dressed Chinese ladies in lovely kimonos, and I was walking by and there was a terrific honk. You can't realise it. It was shocking.
Yes, I'd like to ask you now about your journey out of Rangoon. Mm.
Well, when we took the supplies back to the aerodrome, they were dispersed on about five lorries, foodstuffs, when they sorted out what they want, and I was then told that we'd got to evacuate because the planes could no longer operate from there, and that we would go back farther up to another airfield, which is up at Magui. And there were five lorries, and they were put in charge of the padre, who was the Reverend Frillman. He was only quite young. He was, I should imagine, in his late 20s, but he was a very nice chap. I got on with him very well. And we had five lorries. Also, among the people who were going, when the prisons were open, there was one of the AVG men who'd been released from the prison, and he was released, and he had shot a native in Rangoon. What had happened, I think he got a bit squiffy and he was in this restaurant and the wait had taken a long time bringing him a drink. He bought a 45-8 and shot him. Of course, he was put in prison. But when all this evacuation took place, he was released and put in charge of the padre. But I don't think anything happened after that. He went up and he was working around in China later with them. Anyhow, we lined up and set off, and when we got up the road a little way, there was a roadblock, but I think there were a few little armoured cars or Bren gun carriers, which I think would be operated by the Gloucesters, and after a lot of fighting and turning, they apparently broke this roadblock, and we went through, and I tell you, our foots were on the accelerators till we reached Pegu, which was a marvellous place for scenery, and for temples. There are more temples at Pegu, I think, than everything. And we spent the night. We slept in one of those temples that night, and with all the gods looking down on us.
Would you have been, do you think, one of the last lots out of Rangoon?
I think no. I think there was another. There was another small unit of RAF, the ones that had been left behind to destroy the thing, that came out after us. I met them quite a lot afterwards at different places, and we used to talk. Matter of fact, I joined them again when I had to leave the AVG and came back to India with them.
Yes, I'll ask you about that later on.
Yeah.
Yes. The planes they would have been flown out, obviously.
Oh yeah, the planes were flown out. So it was only the few ground crew that were able, and we bought all the supplies that were needed for the AVG. I had the radio truck, which had a few little transmitters and aircraft equipment and stuff, and the others took the armaments and, all these supplies. But when they did evacuate, I think some of them, the fighters, some of the pilots flew out with some sitting in the pilot seat and people sitting on their laps, because it was only a flight of about 200 miles, and they came out when they evacuated.
So after this stop at Pegu, was
yeah,
it?
Yes. Yeah, well, we only stopped there for, I think, about a couple of nights. And then we moved on up to Magui. But we camped at night where we could. But one of the greatest difficulties then, of course, was water. We just, you know, there weren't taps to go to or anything. And we used to get water. We even one night got it out of the Irrawaddy, where a few hundred yards up there were women washing their clothes and the dead bullock floated down. But we used to boil it, and at least we used to make a fire and boil it and make tea, because we had tea. And we used to get also buffalo milk to put in it. We could get hold of that. And we'd make tea, and then I'd fill my water bottle of this boiled water for the next day.
Would that road have been crowded at all with refugees and, you know, other
Well, there
vehicles?
Were quite a lot, but most of the people were on foot. Most of the others who got out by on transport. Actually, reverting to when I saw an exodus, was the main road used to go up past the Mingledon airfield. On one occasion, I saw a fire engine going up. It looked like all the firemen's families and all suitcases, and it was absolutely stacked up with things. They evacuated on anything they could, those that could. But when we came to come out, I think most of the mobile transport like that had gone, and it was people pushing carts and that. But there wasn't an enormous amount then. The Burmese didn't seem to worry so much. It was only the Indians and the Eurasians and Europeans that naturally you realise, but I don't think the Burmese feared that. I think there were a lot of them were pro
Yes, Japanese. I was wondering also, you know, whether they showed any anti-British attitudes to you.
No, they were very silent. They didn't say a lot, and there weren't any things like there were later on in India when it was British go home and all this. There was none of that I noticed in Burma, no. But they were just, you know, didn't seem to take any notice, and but they weren't. But things they used to do, and then they all cleared off too, and wouldn't help in any way. And the fires that used to appear in the jungle at night gave me the indication that they were pretty anti-British at the time.
Yes, that was to indicate to the Japanese
where to drop their bombs.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. And then we went on to Magui, and the planes had pulled in there, and we operated from there for a little while because it was pretty because there were no air raid warnings, and the Japs then had got to the game in that they just fly in and strafe and off again. Would you see? Oh, yeah.